This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about the Dalai Lama with Pico Iyer, a journalist who has had a series of conversations with him dating back 33 years. Iyer's father was a friend of the Tibetan leader. Iyer has written a new book called The Open Road, The Journey of the Dalai Lama. Iyer also wrote the cover story of this week's Time magazine about the Dalai Lama and the current protests in Tibet over Chinese rule. As China prepares to host the Olympics this summer, Tibetans have rioted in protest against Chinese restrictions on their religion and culture. China has responded by arresting hundreds of people. The Tibetan government in exile, which is based in Dharamsala, India, says at least 140 people have died in demonstrations in Tibet and neighboring areas. The Chinese government has blamed the Dalai Lama for the unrest. He's the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhists and the political leader of Tibet in exile. China invaded Tibet in 1950. The Dalai Lama fled in 1959 after Chinese rule became more oppressive and his life was threatened. Pico Iyer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with what's happening in Tibet now. Why are Tibetans rebelling now?
Just out of an uncontainable suffering and frustration that has been going on for 50 years, though of course they know that right now, as the world's attention turns to China, this is the one time when they can make their sorrows heard across the world. And I think it's hard for those of us who've never been to Tibet really to imagine how difficult conditions are there. But the Dalai Lama is for them an incarnation of a god. So it's as if those of us in America were told that if you have a picture of Jesus or if you have a copy of the Quran or if you have anything that speaks for your religious inspiration, you can be thrown into jail for many, many years. And imagine how hard it would be for us in those conditions.
Give us more of a sense of why things are so difficult for Tibetans right now who are living in Tibet.
They've seen the capital of Lhasa turn from a Tibetan city into a largely Chinese city. They're not allowed to have contact with their exiled leader, who is in some sense not just their political leader, but their spiritual faith and even their homeland. And mostly, I think, they're denied freedom of speech and freedom of thought, the most basic things. They're not allowed to practice their religion. And it must be said, as I say all that, that China has brought material prosperity to it and it's brought many good modern developments to Tibet, and I think the Tibetans are grateful for that. They just wish that in the process of gaining these useful new technologies, they didn't have to lose the most fundamental thing of all, which is freedom.
Now, on Tuesday, at least one monk was killed and another critically wounded. Are monks involved in the uprising in Tibet?
Monks have always been the leaders of demonstrations or peace marches in Tibet, partly, of course, because they're the conscience of the culture. Partly, too, monks will often say that they have no wives and children, so they can afford to give their lives to the cause. And partly also because, of course, they're most immediately affected because their whole life is based on the practice of a religion that, if not entirely stifled, is very strongly controlled in contemporary China. So imagine if your whole livelihood was in some ways constantly under surveillance and perhaps taken away from you entirely.
Are monks allowed to live like monks in Tibet?
They are. For example, when I've been to Lhasa, one of the most moving things is to go to a monastery there and to see them chanting their sutras and performing their debates and conducting on the surface the same kind of practices you would have seen 100 years ago. But to some degree, that is all for the benefit of people like me. It's there because the Chinese authorities are aware that foreigners are drawn to Tibet by Tibetan Buddhism and want to see Buddhism being freely practiced in the most visible places. But deep down beneath that, I think they're always looking over their shoulder. And if you ever sneak into a darkened corridor in a monastery in Tibet and somebody is aware that nobody is listening, he'll say, please, please, please take our story to the world. We are living in the equivalent of solitary confinement or lifelong imprisonment.
The people who are violently rebelling in Tibet are rejecting the Dalai Lama's, quote, middle way. What is the middle way?
The middle way really is just about communication and acknowledging that another person has rights just as you do, and always speaking for more dialogue rather than more confrontation. I think it's almost as if, let's say, your sister took away your handbag tomorrow. And you can either punch her or shout at her or sue her or talk to her. probably none of those are going to have an effect because she took the handbag away knowing it would upset you and is unlikely quickly to give it back. But given that she's your sister and given that you're going to have to spend the rest of your lives together, if you sue her or shout her at her or punch her, that's probably going to damage your relationship for life. That's going to make things much harder the next time the two of you are trying to deal. And so he would always say, far and away, the best thing is just to talk to her, to speak to her better nature, to hold to reason, and to think in terms of the fact that your destiny is intertwined with this other person for the next 50 years. So to precipitate a confrontation now is maybe to resolve the issue this moment, but to leave unimaginable bad consequences for every future moment.
And what the Dalai Lama is asking for isn't independence from China, it's autonomy. What's the difference between the two in his mind?
He has said for 21 years now that China is free to take control of and continue controlling Tibet's defense affairs and foreign affairs, but please can Tibet just have control over, as it were, its domestic world, which, if you think about it, is a Buddhist notion, and it's certainly not a confrontational notion. As you know, many of the people around him are speaking for absolute independence, but he's always said that Tibet needs China as well as China needs Tibet. And one thing that I think is startling about him and speaks for what makes him such a kind of liberating politician is that he says that Tibetans need material progress and they're very grateful to China for bringing them what China has brought them. So he would never want Tibet to be separate from China or vice versa, but he would just like Tibet to enjoy normal human freedoms within its own territory.
Do you think the Dalai Lama himself has doubts about the middle way, since China hasn't budged? I mean, the Dalai Lama had to flee Tibet in 1959. It's been nearly 50 years, and, you know, things have, if anything, maybe gotten worse?
No, you're absolutely right, and yet I think he has no doubts at all, because I think his policy comes from so deeply rooted and clearly reasoned a philosophy. In fact, I remember more than 10 years ago I was talking to him in Dharamsala, and he said, well, if you look at it one way, my policy is hopeless. The more concessions I make, the more I open the door to China, the more they crack down on people in Tibet. And I think as a human being and as a very compassionate human being, his heart is constantly breaking for what the people in Tibet are going through. But at the same time, I think he's unwaveringly confident that this, in the long term, is the best policy. And I don't think he will move from this policy. And remember that as a monk, one of his first commitments is to nonviolence. So to ask him to embrace violence would be like asking the Pope to sanctify Martin Luther or something. It's not going to happen. And I think, you know, the other thing that it's easy for us to forget is that I think some people might imagine the Dalai Lama is somewhat unworldly monk, or that he's a naive or a neophyte when it comes to politics. And I think we often overlook the fact that he's in fact the most seasoned ruler on the planet. He's been in charge of his people now for 67 years. And whenever I see him, what strikes me most of all is that he's a hyper-realist. In fact, to me, he's a greater pragmatist than most of the other politicians I've met in my life as a journalist. And so I don't think he's under any illusions about either China or how the world works. But he also understands that the only way to change the way the world works in the long run is to stick to these clear and peace-loving policies.
You know, we've been talking about how the Dalai Lama's middle way hasn't gotten any concessions from China. And the Dalai Lama is actually considering stepping down as the political leader of the Tibetans, but not as the spiritual leader. What would it mean for him to step down as the political leader, and why is he considering doing that?
I think it's really just a symbolic act. And actually, I must say, he's been saying this for 15 years now, that if violence continues either among the Tibetan exile community or especially within Tibet itself, he'll have to depose himself. But really, that means very little, because one of the main things he's done in exile is to set up a democratically elected government. So there is a prime minister in Dharamsala, and there's a cabinet, and there's a fully functioning political framework there. And yet, every Tibetan will only essentially listen to the Dalai Lama. And so in some ways he's in a fix because he can't dethrone himself. And one of the interesting curiosities of the Tibetan situation is that the Dalai Lama has been trying to push democracy onto his people ever since he arrived in India in 1960. And his people have been saying, no, 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 please, we don't want democracy. We just want to listen to you. And so one way or another, there's nothing he can do to avoid being the leader of the Tibetans. And I must say, when we talk about his relations with China, I think one of the essential things that's worth remembering is that because he's unillusioned, he doesn't expect the Chinese leadership to come to its senses overnight, as it were, or to undergo some great spiritual transformation. But for 15, 20 years now, he's been talking about how much faith he has in Chinese individuals. So one gamble, as it were, he's taken for more than 20 years now is at every point to open the door to contacts with Chinese individuals, whether he's in India or whether he's traveling. And I think slowly, one by one, transformations are happening, and all of that is bearing fruit. And his determination never to stigmatize or demonize the Chinese people who have suffered so much at the hands of their governments is really paying off.
You know, it's kind of incomprehensible to me that, like, everybody knows that the Dalai Lama stands for nonviolence, and yet China is accusing him of provoking the uprising in Tibet.
It makes no sense. His fundamental principle is interdependence, and they call him a splittist. And his other fundamental principle is that there are no enemies in the world. The enemy is a creation in the head, and they call him an enemy of the people. And he says, throwing his hands up, in some ways, just what you said, I've done everything I can, and still they demonize me. All I can do is wait.
Has there been a big divide in the Dalai Lama's life between his role as the political leader of the Tibetans and the spiritual leader?
I think not, because I think all his political actions arise from his spiritual principles, which is partly, again, what makes him such an unusual politician. He's the only leader in the world, political leader, who's a monk. And so I think it's not akin to some of us saying, well, we're good at science and bad at history, or we have a strength in one position and a deficiency in the other. I think for him, all of these are intertwined. And when he speaks politically, he's only speaking on the basis of the principles that he has clarified for himself as a monk.
Now, he says, and you describe this in your book, he says spiritually we can change our world by changing how we choose to look at the world. That suffering is the state of the world, but unhappiness is just how we choose to look at the world, or we can choose not to look at the world that way. That kind of makes sense on a spiritual level, but politically, I don't see how you can tell people whose country has basically become a living prison, who have been denied basic fundamental rights by the Chinese government, many of them are literally in prison. How do you just tell them, well, unhappiness is just a way of looking at the world, so meditate, open up your mind and heart, and change your way of looking at the world and you'll feel better? Do you know what I'm saying? It's not much of a political solution.
It's not, and clearly he's aware of that. But I think in some ways, he's not, as it were, giving them placebos or passing on aphorisms that won't help them in the day-to-day. I think he's just saying, well, remember that freedom can be thought of in many ways. I am working night and day to try to give you those basic freedoms. I'm doing everything I can to conduct negotiations with China. But in the meantime, remember that there are myriad freedoms. And some of his monks, for example, will say that even though they're deprived of so many other things, as long as they can keep that space open in their heart, something is okay.
Where do you think the situation in Tibet might lead? I mean, the Olympics are coming up this summer. China is going to be hosting people from around the world. Heads of state have to decide how they're going to deal with this. Are they going to go to the opening ceremony or not? Are they going to go to the Olympics or not? What are some of the possible scenarios that will play out now?
Well, the Dalai Lama, and I think he's right in this, has never spoken about boycotting the Olympics. And he feels that if you cast China or anyone into isolation, that only aggravates the problem and creates abstractions in the head. I think the best possibility would be for the heads of state, whose approval China so much depends on, to urge them to talk to the Dalai Lama and urge them to open Tibet to independent investigation, and just use the particular sway they have over China in these few months to try to talk to China's leaders, just to talk to the Dalai Lama.
And do you think that the protests will quiet down, or do you think that they're going to get more confrontational?
I think we're going to see them continue right the way through the next 5 months until the Olympics are complete. And it's interesting, again, the Dalai Lama, long before all of these recent disturbances began, said that his main concern was for what happened after the Olympics are over. Everyone is assuming that China will put on its best face and will be on its best behavior while the world's attention is turned to it in these next few months. But what happens when we all start thinking about the presidential election in November, or we start thinking about an uprising elsewhere? Then it might be able to prosecute some fairly terrible things. And that's perhaps the time when we most need to be thinking both about China and Tibet.
There are so many contradictions in the Dalai Lama's life that he has to contend with. Like, one of them is that he's keeping alive a society in exile, and this is a society that before it was exiled had been isolated from the world. And now he is so much in the world, and he's made many changes intentionally in that culture. You write about many of the reforms that he's made in Dharamsala, which is the capital of Tibet in exile. What are some of the ways he's intentionally changed Tibetan culture?
I think he's thrown out everything that he regarded as just ritualistic or outdated from old Tibet that he felt was stifling Tibet. He's allowed women to study for doctoral degrees and to become abbots as they never could before. He's introduced science into his monks' curriculum. I think everything has been about trying to incorporate Tibet into the modern larger world. And one small measure he's taken, for example, is to say that Tibetan children in exile should take all their lessons into the Tibetan language until they're 10 years old, so that they'll be deeply rooted in their own culture and tradition, and then take all their lessons in English thereafter, so they'll be connected to the modern world.
You've met a lot of the young people who are living in exile in Dharamsala, and they yearn for a Tibet that they've never seen, they've never lived in, and that actually no longer exists and probably will never exist again because the Chinese have changed it too much. There's some things where you just can't go back. So they're in quite a predicament.
They are. It's a very poignant thing because, of course, with every breath, they're fighting and yearning for Tibet. But as you say, they've never seen Tibet. Meanwhile, the people in Tibet itself haven't seen their own leader in most cases for 49 years. And so you see these two communities both in a kind of limbo. And your heart goes out to, I think, such individuals. But the thing that the Dalai Lama always says is just what you said. You can't go back. And unfortunately, the only practical thing we can do now is to try and construct a stronger settlement in exile as possible, and to work to the transformation of Chinese minds one by one.
The Dalai Lama is revered as a god by his followers, and he's considered to be a living reincarnation of the Buddha. Does he see himself as a god?
No, the opposite. And I think just like the Buddha, he sees himself entirely as a human being. The fiercest I ever saw him was once when I carelessly, in an article 20 years ago, referred to him, as many do, as a living Buddha. And he really took my two words apart the next time I saw him, because the whole essence of his philosophy is not that he's somebody up in the clouds doing miraculous things. He's somebody just like you or I. And in some ways, the Dalai Lama's message when he travels around the world is not just that he is kind and clear-sighted and selfless, which I think he is, but that any one of us can be so if so we apply ourselves. When I saw him traveling through Japan 4 months ago, a journalist came up to him and asked him, as probably many journalists do, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to resolve the situation in the Middle East? And the Dalai Lama just looked at him and said, silly question. If I had a magic wand, I'd resolve the situation in Tibet, I'd bring world peace, I'd find a cure for cancer, I'd help my own health. I don't have a magic wand. I'm just a human being with the same struggles and conflicts and challenges as any of you. And I think that's exactly where his potential lies, showing that he's a regular human being in the midst of a difficult situation, but trying every now and then to rise above it, and any of us could try to do that in our own lives.
Now, you first knew of the Dalai Lama through your father, who met the Dalai Lama in, was it around 1960?
That's right. The very year after the Dalai Lama came into exile, when I think most people didn't really know who or what he was, my father, who was teaching philosophy at Oxford and was very interested in Buddhism, realized suddenly for the first time in history this great treasure was available to everybody. So he went and scheduled a meeting with the Dalai Lama, and because not many people were approaching the Dalai Lama in those days, it was relatively easy. And they had a long talk about philosophical issues. And interestingly enough, my father told the Dalai Lama, well, I have this little three-year-old son in Oxford, and he's been taking a keen interest in the flight of Tibetans into exile. And the Dalai Lama, with his characteristic aptness, found a picture of himself when he was 5 years old, already on the lion throne in Lhasa, and sent it through my father to me in Oxford.
And what did that picture mean to you?
Well, for the next 30 years, it sat on my desk. And I think whenever I felt burdened or I thought, oh, life is very difficult for me as a small boy alone in a foreign country, I just had to look at that picture of a five-year-old who is responsible for 6 million people and is already the leader of his people and put things into perspective. And then the one other thing I should say is that the picture followed me over with my family when we moved to California, remained on my desk, and then one day a forest fire broke out half a mile away from our house, wiped out our house, wiped out everything in it, and I lost the picture. And so in some ways, I learnt one of the fundamental Buddhist truths about impermanence. A picture can be inspiring, but it's not going to be around forever.
Now, you see the Dalai Lama as having a special interest in science. And I wonder, since the connection between science and religion, or the lack of a connection, is such a kind of much talked about issue in the United States, how does the Dalai Lama see science and faith as being connected?
The last time I saw him, he said expressly the Buddha was a scientist. He was an empiricist. And in the Dalai Lama's reading of Buddhism, faith plays very small a part, as with the Buddha himself, who said, let's not speculate on the afterworld or the existence of God, or let's not even address those issues. Let's deal with the here and now. And so if you listen to the Dalai Lama speak when next he comes to the U.S., you'll notice that the verbs he loves are investigate, analyze, explore. And really, that is the way that he tackles everything around him. Indeed, in the wake of these recent disturbances, his response to China was, let's conduct an investigation. And that was such a characteristic response because investigation is what he's all about. And he very eagerly seeks out Catholic monks and goes to Muslim mosques to learn what they can teach him about a spiritual life. But at the same time, he's talking to neuroscientists and I think might well define himself as a scientist. And I think that offers, as your question suggests, an interesting possibility at a time when science and religion are so much at odds for somebody who's going back and forth and trying to find the common places between them.
You say that he added science to the course of study for Tibetan monks. Was it intentionally absent before?
It was. I think one of the problems, it seems, with old Tibet was that education was almost entirely monastic education there. I think there were very few schools. It was just monks who got educated. And I think their training was rigorously, intensely philosophical, which is one reason why they've come to so many of these realizations that they're sharing now with us. But perhaps philosophy to the exclusion of many other things. And the Dalai Lama himself said to me 15 years ago, our biggest mistake, our greatest mistake in Tibet was isolation, being too cut off from the other world. And as somebody who speaks for communication, I think introducing science into the curriculum is his way of trying to ensure that there'll be as many channels open as possible between the Tibetan community and even the monastic community and the modern techno world at large.
Now, you describe the Dalai Lama as being, in his own way, a scientist, an empiricist, but at the same time, he uses oracles. And you saw one of the oracles work. Would you describe what you saw?
I went into a little temple at dawn in Dharamsala, and I saw a very quiet monk come out and sit in a kind of throne. There were about 50 of us in this small chapel, and for 10 minutes nothing happened. He was just silent, and I felt I could almost see him descend into himself. And then suddenly he began shaking and convulsing. And although he was wearing a crown that weighed 70 pounds, I found out later, he began jerking around the room and froth was coming from his mouth. And then words began to come out of his mouth. And he is the official state oracle who Tibetans believe speak for a certain deity. So he began clattering around the room as he was supposed to do, as the ritual was meant to encourage. And two monks stood by his side and transcribed all the words they heard coming out of his mouth. And it's true that the Dalai Lama has often said that some of his most critical decisions have come from the counsel that he's received through this deity speaking via a human medium. Indeed, when he fled Tibet, it was the Nechung oracle who told him, you've got to leave today, and who actually gave him the map of the best route by which to take off from Lhasa. So I think when I, as a non-Buddhist, am confronted by something like that, all I can say is, I don't know what's going on. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not in a position to say anything about it. But it's certainly true that, as your question suggests, there are all these rites and customs in Tibetan Buddhism that are something very different from the logic and the scientific procedure that the Dalai Lama so often speaks for.
There's a quote from the Buddha on the wall of the temple next to the Dalai Lama's home, and it reads, "As one assays gold by rubbing, cutting, and melting, so examine all my words and accept them, but not because you respect me." What does that mean to you?
In my book, I think what I was trying to do was to cross-question the Dalai Lama and to interrogate him as intensely as I think he likes to interrogate the world. And the reason for that is I think often I speak for myself. I remember when I would go to listen to him 20 years ago, I'd come out of the hall saying, what a kind man, or what a great sense of humor, or how striking that he immediately goes off to that little girl in the wheelchair. And I think he speaks for kindness and he embodies kindness, but to say all that is in some ways to diminish him. And I thought that really, insofar as he's trying to take these principles around the world, just the way an Emerson or a Newton might do, the best thing I could do was to hold them up against the light of the global world that I've witnessed. And just as that quotation suggests, not to take anything on faith, not just to say, well, this is an impressive man speaking for peace, but really to bring challenges at him from every direction and to see how well his positions stood up for them. And I think that's what he's always saying. He's the rare leader who likes to be challenged, likes even to be proven wrong.
So tell us about a time when you asked him a challenging question. And what kind of response you got from him?
Well, I'll tell you about a friend of mine who was a Buddhist monk and is a translator for the Dalai Lama and is also gay. And the Dalai Lama has often said, because of ancient Tibetan texts, at least for monks, homosexuality isn't a good idea, because there's a text from 2,000 years ago that speaks against those forms of sexual union. So he takes a fairly strong line on that position. And my friend, who's a Tibetan scholar, went to him and said, actually, I think the text was different and it was mistranslated. And if you look at this text, it opens onto a very different possibility. And the Dalai Lama said, well, I will look at that text. If you're right, I'd be more than happy to change my position. And I'm so grateful to you for presenting this other approach to these texts. And I think that's the way he is almost with everybody.
The Dalai Lama isn't doctrinal like some leaders of Western religions, but you point out that a lot of Western admirers would be disappointed to hear about the things he disapproves of. He disapproves of homosexuality, which you've already discussed as a good example, divorce, sexual license, intoxicants, which I assume includes drugs and alcohol. Do you think most of his Western followers know that?
I think they do, because what they tend to ask him as soon as he comes to a large hall in Philadelphia or Los Angeles is about their personal lives and, for example, their relations with their wives or their girlfriends or their teachers. And one of the first things he often says is, I don't know, I'm a celibate monk. I'm the last person you should be asking for marital counsel. But I think they do know that, and I think they are made a little uneasy about it, and maybe that is one reason why, as the years have gone on, he's more and more, when he travels in the West, told people, please don't take up Buddhism. Please work within your own cultural traditions where your roots are deepest. And I think that's because he's seen some of the confusions or misinterpretations that can result when we too eagerly embrace another tradition without realizing all the very different cultural and traditional baggage that it involves. And it's interesting, you know, he is the rare Buddhist to tell people, please don't become Buddhists.
You're not a Buddhist, right?
I'm not a Buddhist.
Do you practice any religion?
No, I have my convictions, and I suppose I've worked hard over many years to try to fashion exactly what my direction and my position is. And I've been lucky because I was born to Hindu parents. I went through Christian schooling. I've lived for more than 20 years in deeply Buddhist Japan, and I spent 9 years researching and writing a book on Islam. So I'm a happy global citizen who's been able to learn from many, many traditions. But in myself, I've tried to create what most makes sense to somebody who belongs to many countries. The great Peggy Lee once famously said, "I learnt how to live from Jesus, Cary Grant and Buddha." And I thought, well, that's not a bad formulation. Any of us could probably gain from those three.
Pico, I think it's fair to say that correct me if I'm wrong, that the Dalai Lama is very interested in other religions.
Very interested. And in fact, again, startles his flock, as it were, his followers, by saying that Tibetans have a lot that they can learn from Catholics, as well as vice versa, and of course from other religions too. He's gone out of his way to visit places of worship from every tradition. And I think one of his great enthusiasms, and he says his second central mission, is to speak for the harmony of religions. But he never says there should be one synthetic world religion. Again, he uses the analogy of medicine, and he says some bodies are best treated if they have cancer, say, by radiation, and some by chemotherapy, and some by perhaps Chinese herbs. So there ought to be a variety of practical responses to suffering and the world, and that we should never try just to pretend that there's no difference between Catholicism and Buddhism, say.
I want to play you a soundbite, and this is from a few years ago. I was interviewing Tim LaHaye. He's a very powerful figure on the religious right, and he's the co-author of the Left Behind series, the series of novels
yes.
about the apocalypse and the second coming of Jesus and the tribulations of the people who are left behind to suffer because they have not been born again. So I said to him, you believe that the only true faith is born-again Christianity and that only born-again Christians will be redeemed and go to heaven. You know, during this time on earth, what are your feelings toward people of other faiths or your feelings about people who are Christians but not born again Christians? Do you respect their faiths? Do you respect them as Catholics or Jews or Muslims? And he said, well, I respect them for what they believe and I try to be respectful toward all people and yet disagree with what they believe. And then he talks about how Jesus is the truth. He is the way that God has prescribed to come. And he says, no man comes to the Father but by him. And I want to play you what he said next.
I'll tell you a little secret. I was in the Holy Land when they were having a religious conclave, and who should be walking down the hall toward me with an entourage but the Dalai Lama. And I didn't know. Here I am, a minister from America visiting, and I just stuck out my hand and shook hands with him and said, "Sir, has anyone ever explained to you who Jesus Christ really is? If they haven't, I'd be glad to spend an hour with you and just to share with you the truth about him." And his aide, of course, brushed me off and told me that he was busy, he didn't have time. But that was just an involuntary response to a man who is very religious and very pious and probably very sincere. But he doesn't know the truth of the way to God. And I think we Christians have to be ready at any moment to share that truth with him.
That was Tim LaHaye. I think I was kind of speechless after he said that because it sounded as if he was expecting to be able to convert the Dalai Lama to Christianity. I guess I'm interested in hearing your response to what Tim LaHaye had to say and how you would have responded to him had he said that to you.
I would have said, well, Mr. LaHaye, I wonder if you have read the book called The Good Heart, in which the Dalai Lama delivers a series of lectures on the Gospels and goes line by line through the Gospels before a group of Christians in London. And as he speaks about the Transfiguration and many of the great moments in Jesus' life, tears came to his eyes, and I think tears came to the eyes of many of the lifelong Christians in that room. And one of the beauties, I think, of the Dalai Lama's life or fortune is that, of course, although a Buddhist, he spent the majority of his life in a Hindu country, taking a lot of inspiration from the Hindu Gandhi. And many of his closest associates and friends and people who are working for the same thing as he is are Christians. Desmond Tutu, very notably, I think Vaclav Havel, Jimmy Carter. When he's looking for associates in trying to share with the world some sense that we may partake of a larger identity, it's in fact those Christian people that by circumstance he's found himself working with. So I think the Dalai Lama would have been very glad to be told about Jesus by Mr. LaHaye, but I think he would have known most of that already.
But you think he probably wouldn't have wanted to be told that Christianity was the one true way, the only way?
He wouldn't mind being told that. I remember I saw him once with Desmond Tutu in Vancouver 4 years ago, and it's lovely to see the two of them together because each has suffered so much and worked so hard for his cause. When you see them together, it's almost like somebody who's been working in isolation for a long time meeting someone who absolutely understands him. So they just love one another and can't get enough of one another's company. And at one point, Desmond Tutu accepted an honorary degree and sat down. Then the Dalai Lama came up, and he looked around and he beamed at his old friend. And he said, Archbishop Tutu and I have exactly the same aim. I love listening to him. We do have differences because I don't believe in a creator and he does, and those are important differences, but I'm so thrilled to be working with somebody who thinks about the same aim. So again, he's very clear in where Buddhism and other religions can converge, but what is non-negotiable and where they cannot converge.
What happens after the Dalai Lama dies? I mean, he is believed to be the reincarnation of the Buddha. He was discovered to be that reincarnation when he was... Was it three or something? Four? How old was he?
Yes, he was discovered to be the incarnation when he was two, and he was actually brought to Lhasa and installed on the throne when he was four.
Right. I mean, that's an amazing way of looking at the world and at a child and at the ability of somebody to symbolically lead their people. And I think it's a very difficult concept for Westerners to comprehend. But given the faith in the Dalai Lama, what happens when he dies, particularly now that Tibet no longer exists in the way that he did when he was discovered?
Well, that's such a good question. And needless to say, I think it's the question the Dalai Lama has been asking himself almost since the day he came into exile. And in fact, for 39 years now, since he was in his mid-30s, he has said, if I die, the next Dalai Lama will by definition be somebody who's continuing my own work. In other words, if China suddenly alights on a little boy who's 4 years old and say, this is the new Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama is preempting that option by saying he's not, because by definition, a 15th Dalai Lama will only be somebody who's continuing along the path and extending the work of the 14th Dalai Lama. But he's also said there may be no future Dalai Lama. It's one of the radical things that he's unsettled his people by saying. He said the next Dalai Lama may be a woman. He's open to any possibility. But my suspicion is that he's already put very firmly in place a system whereby as soon as he leaves the world, and he's 72 years old now, another figure or some group of people will be there whom the Tibetans have been instructed to listen to. Because you're absolutely right. Although there is a democratically elected prime minister there, the Tibetans for centuries have only listened reflexively to the Dalai Lama. So he has to find somebody else that they will listen to with the same trustfulness.
Pico Iyer, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Maybe we should end with a song by Leonard Cohen.
you have a
nice list at the end of the book of books and records that have inspired you and that are similar in thought to the way you're thinking in the book. And Leonard Cohen has lived with Buddhist monks. And I know you've been a fan of his music for many years. So what do you think? Song by Leonard Cohen?
Yes. I mean, actually, the particular song, which I'm sure you know, in fact, I heard your lovely conversation with him last 2 years ago, but his song, If It Be Your Will, which I think is addressed to his Buddhist teacher, that's, I think, one of his greatest songs. It would be a lovely note to end on.
Perfect. Thank you.
If it be your will that I speak no more, and my voice be still as it was before, I will speak no more, I shall abide until I am spoken for. If it be your will, if it be your will, let a voice be true from this broken hill. I will sing to you from this broken hill. Let me sing.
That's Leonard Cohen singing If It Be Your Will. Before that, we heard from Pico Iyer, the author of the new book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. Back during the Cold War, Russian authorities were fond of denouncing rock music as capitalist decadence. But after Gorbachev introduced reforms, the police eased up on underground Russian culture, and rock music took off. One leading group, Auction, has devoted the past several years to cracking the American market. Music critic Milo Miles says they have a good chance of succeeding.
It's just a guess, but I would bet that, for Americans, Russia has the largest, least-known rock legacy. During the openness of Glasnost, one of the many bands that sprang up in St. Petersburg, the epicenter of Russian culture, was Auction. Their new album, Girls Sing, confirms that they are more than worthy to come in from the cold. Any 20-plus-year-old Western rock band would be proud to deliver such vibrant, loose, and confident work, particularly on the first studio album in 12 years. In addition to 8 regular members, Auction have several adventurous, eclectic guest stars on Girls Sing. Organist John Medeski, guitarist Mark Rebo, and klezmatics trumpeter Frank London. These players add a welcome jamming feel to the tracks, which were recorded last year in New York, but they are enriching an already developed band sound. Auction began as jagged art punks who liked Frank Zappa as much as the Gang of Four, but they've always had a voracious appetite for new styles. As they dart up, down, and around rhythms that spring from free jazz as much as Russian folk dances, you never know what Auction is going to throw at you. Punk yammer, klezmer, gypsy, circus marches, atonal squawks, or even the number Girls Sing itself, which sounds like a long prog rock workout as well as an avant big band showpiece. Throughout, vocals from songwriter and guitarist Leonid Fedorov and lyricist and keyboardist Dmitry Ozirsky add dabs of longing, anger, and mania, with particularly brash hollers and chants coming from Oleg Garkusha, who's sort of the group's wild man dancer. Auction is very upfront that they care about their often literary or absurdist lyrics. For instance, stop the plane, I want to get off. But they emphasize that understanding the words isn't necessary. They want to deliver the old-fashioned rock and roll surprise and celebration. In addition to Girls Sing, Auction have a well-selected anthology of earlier material called Pioneer, and a media-rich, informative website. Check out the albums, and if you can, try to catch them on their short current U.S. tour. I want to see these Russians coming and coming back.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Girls Sing by Auction. The group performs in Chicago on Friday, Denver on Saturday, San Francisco on Sunday, and winds up their tour in Los Angeles on Tuesday. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Menhivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Долго не бывал где, не был я, не падал я, был, не был над землёю, над водою как-то, где-то как ты, где ты как я.